From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
Not so many years ago, relative to the history of horticulture, even a now ubiquitous phrase like pollinator plant wasn't part of our everyday gardening language and mindset the way it is today. Our collective consciousness about the importance of native plants has grown fast, and with it have come more new words for our vocabulary. One phrase that I've heard a lot lately is keystone plant, an expression I probably didn't even know 5 years ago, describing native species that are disproportionately important to local ecosystems, the sort of powerhouse plants of all. I wanted to learn more about just what keystone plants are and which ones belong in my garden and why, and Uli Lorimer, Director of Horticulture at Native Plant Trust, is here to help explain all that. So more in a moment, but first, these messages.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden provided by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, a third-generation bulb company offering top-size flower bulbs directly to landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners on the web, colorblends.com. And by High Mowing Seeds, Wolcott, Vermont, professional quality vegetable, flower, and herbal seeds that are 100% organic and non-GMO project verified. On the web, highmowingseeds.com. And by White Flower Farm, offering a wide range of carefully selected and expertly grown garden plants. On the web, whiteflowerfarm.com.
Today's guest, Uli Lorimer, is the Director of Horticulture at Native Plant Trust in New England, and he also writes the Ask the Gardener column for the Boston Globe. He has devoted his career to native plants, and I'm so glad to welcome him back to the program today. How are you over there across Massachusetts from me?
trying to stay warm, but delighted to be here.
Good luck with that. So, as I said in the introduction, you know, I think the phrase keystone plants, it's one that's spoken a lot lately. Do you remember the first time you heard it?
I probably put myself in your camp maybe about 5 to 7 years ago, and would also really credit Doug Tallamy for bringing this to sort of more of the public's awareness. You know, in researching the concept itself, it dates back quite a ways, several decades ago. When it was first coined, came out of oceanographic research, and I think it's one of these concepts that I think has generated a lot of discussion, at least in the ecology world. Generated lots of sort of associated terms like indicator species and flagship species and functional groups and all these sorts of things that I think have really helped move the needle in how we think about the role of gardens and the environment and how they interact with each other.
So even before it had this name, keystone plants, that as you said, Doug Tallamy of the University of Delaware and Homegrown National Park, his nonprofit, has helped popularize in more recent years. It was kind of out there, and I forgot it came from the ocean. I forgot it came from that. Right.
A Dr. Payne who coined it and had discovered that, you know, when you remove one particular species in this system that he was studying, it had a sort of cascade of negative effects, and he thought, wow, like, this is sort of akin to that keystone that sits at the center of an arch and keeps the whole thing together. And if you remove it, then these ecosystems collapse.
Right. And so originally, I guess, as native plants have become more and more the subject of research and more widely used and so forth, I mean, a lot of the research initially was probably comparing the impact on the ecosystems of native versus non-native plants. I would imagine that's probably where it began, yeah? And then more like natives compared to one another. And from there we went dot, dot, dot. We found the keystones, the ones that were the most impactful, right? Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's generally the
oversimplifying, excuse me.
Well, but I think that, you know, what I've come to recognize nowadays is that you know, ecological horticulture is really multidisciplinary, in which you have to draw from, you know, data sets and pools of information and expertise from the entomology world, from the ornithology world, from those who study fungi, and that, you know, the interactions of particular insect group with plants has probably long been well known, but unknown to the horticultural world until we started putting together these pieces and connecting the dots, as you just did.
And some of the and once that became more of a, you know, the these research studies happened, including by Doug Tallamy's team and other colleagues in the native plant world. I mean, some of the statistics, some of the numbers are pretty astonishing. Like, I remember the one, because he has focused us a lot on the importance of caterpillars, of the Lepidoptera and the caterpillars and how they support the food webs so critically. And, you know, I think it was like 14% of native plant species support 90% of the caterpillars that then in turn support the terrestrial food web. You know, like these, it's this small number. And again, those sort of, quote, keystones,
Yeah, I mean, you know, if we could define this sort of in the modern sense as something that has a disproportionate impact on biodiversity far beyond its abundance on the landscape. And I think that you know, drawing the connections with butterflies and moths and the earlier stages of their lives, and the fact that you know, I read 96% of all songbirds need insects to be reproductively successful, and I was really astonished to hear that. And then a friend of mine, Dr. Desiree Narango, published a study a few years back, kind of quantifying this for Carolina chickadees. And I often cite this research that a pair of chickadees requires more than 5,000 caterpillars to raise a brood of chicks in a season, which is just a stupefying amount of caterpillars if you think about it. And where are they going to find it?
I always say that caterpillars are the baby food of the songbird set. You know what I mean? That's my popular way of saying it. You know, the because really that is even birds who are not songbird species who are not as adults as predominantly insectivorous at that time in their life cycle, in their life history, when they are raising a brood, that is the baby food. That is the go-to stuff. Even if they, you know, use seeds much more, or insect, you know, or other creatures, other things, you know, other sources of food much more, especially seeds. But you know,
well, it stands to reason that you know, seeds and fruit are resources that are more abundant in the later parts of the year,
right?
And you know, there's this sort of beautiful convergence of not only plants emerging and flowering, but also all that insect life and biodiversity and biomass that's so well timed with the plants all coming together at the same time to really, you know. And I was just thinking that despite the fact that a pair of chickadees might clean out 5,000 caterpillars in immediate vicinity, there's still more for all of those moths and butterflies to complete their life cycle. I mean, you know, there must be literally tens of thousands hiding in the forests, if not more, that we never see because they're all up high in the canopy.
Yeah. And apparently the caterpillars are protein packed, I guess. You know, I mean, they're a really dense form of nutrition. So that's critical for those little babies too, I think.
But I think one of the big shifts here, I think, is that, you know, we may have assumed that, you know, adjacent nearby natural spaces were intact enough to support all of these organisms, and that, you know, we could really focus our gardens on just being pretty. And I think that there's a growing realization that the health of forests and meadows and so forth is maybe not as great as we thought, and that, you know, gardeners who really wish to make a positive impact are thinking, what kind of intentional choices can I make in my gardens to help, to help kind of create wildlife corridors or provide resources that just aren't reliably in the environment anymore. I think a lot of this is what drives this movement forward.
So at Native Plant Trust, and then dot, 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 sort of if we can translate some of the lessons of how you think about when you and your team go about the work that you do, deciding what plants to use. You know, you have propagation operations, you have a lot of different things going on besides two properties and more, I guess, that you're also conserving, but the two primary locations. And how do you decide kind of what the role of Keystone plants, like how often does this come up in your work, and how should we gardeners, like, you know, be thinking about Keystone plants? Because I mean, can we even list the Keystone plants? It's not the same in every region or anything.
And, you know, and I think about our, you know, one of our core missions is also to educate the public about all the stories around native plants. And so we do quite a lot of research in the winter to try to uncover what those relationships are between a particular species and maybe an insect herbivore or a specialist bee or specialist pollinator, or if it's a host for a particular butterfly or moth. And I think that we strive to find ways to incorporate those plants into our displays with the belief that that we're providing not just something beautiful for humans to enjoy and a sense of place, but also a missing resource for these organisms. The challenge, I think, which you know, in any garden is, you know, where, how do you find the balance between species diversity and biodiversity? And you could make the argument that lots of different things is a net benefit for the wild versus a design that is legible to us that we can make sense of, and that there's sort of a balance and a middle ground between, you know, what we get out of gardens and what we're providing for the local wildlife. And so I think that's always a little bit of a push and pull where we love plants. We want to grow everything we possibly can. But sometimes the site conditions don't allow us to grow everything. And so you have to make hard choices sometimes.
Right. And finding out which ones, though, are the keystones of our area. I mean, it feels like that's a really good educational first step. I mean, understanding that, knowing what they are, both the woody plants and the herbaceous plants. I mean, I know that, you know, Doug Talmy, he wrote a whole book about oaks, and oaks are in various habitats, powerhouses, you know, definite powerhouses, and it all makes sense. And then there's other woody plants, but also, again, you know, herbaceous perennials and so forth.
Yeah, a lot of herbaceous perennials, too. I mean, and there's some good resources. You know, the National Wildlife Foundation has some great lists that are based on his work. You know, I'll say that there's not like a one-stop shop to figure out everything that there is. And a lot of the research now is skewed towards caterpillars, which, you know, we've connected really well with bird life. But there's still a whole lot we don't know about insect herbivores, you know, other stem cavity nesters, you know, organisms that use plants as habitat, not necessarily just as food. You know, all of this, if I take a step back, I think that, you know, we're all trending towards this, this greater awareness, because there's a realization that our choices have real positive impacts for the environment. I think that's really what this is boils down to. And that, you know, welcoming native plants is a welcome step, but you don't have to be a purist about it in your gardens. You know, horticulture has introduced a lot of really beautiful plants from other parts of the world. Some of them, we'll say, have turned out to be harmful as they have escaped. But the reality is that wildlife interacts with all of them in one way or another. And I think that Doug Talamy's message of aiming for 70% native is a really good one, because It's a goal. It's a journey upon which each individual gardener can decide how fast and how quickly they work towards it, as long as you don't lose that intention of trying to make a forward-thinking choice that's going to help protect what remains of our wild.
Mm-hmm. So if, for instance, I want to think about, I think what we're, one thing that I'm hearing you say is that the keystone plants for caterpillars might be a little bit different than the list of keystone plants for, say, bees, like pollinators. Yes.
Yes.
So if I wanted to think about pollinators, for instance, and I wanted to think about perennials, herbaceous perennials, flowering perennials, would I be looking probably, and I'm going to guess that in like the aster family, the sort of daisy-like flowers, and also like maybe the mint family, because that's where I see a lot of the action in my garden, you know.
And I'd throw in the carrot family too, the Apiaceae.
Oh, right, the umbels.
The umbels are really wonderful.
Right.
But, you know, what a lot of those, particularly the aster family, what they share is a, you know, a general flower shape that accepts all comers. It doesn't matter if you're a, you know, a big muscular bumblebee or a small or sweat bee or something.
Accessibility.
And now there are, you know, and because of this long relationship that flower shape and insect shape have driven specialization, you know, it's good to have the generalist in there. And you also need to provide for, you know, specialists that need, it's not just flower shape. Like I was just thinking about spring beauties and the spring beauty mining bee. And here's like a really close little relationship that that bee needs the particular nectar and pollen of that plant to be reproductively successful and nothing mm-hmm. else. There's no substitute for it. And so I think this is where favoring a native species to support those specialists is a really good, there's a strong argument to be made for that.
Because the generalist could use that as well as many other things.
Absolutely.
You know, right. So we need to, right.
Yeah,
okay.
You know, you could have you know, a lawn full of crocuses and spring beauties, and you get both the support for the specialist and you know, maybe a little bit more design choices with the crocuses. But we know crocuses aren't going to take over the world. And even if they did, that wouldn't be so bad.
Right. So, okay. So, but what we're saying is we're going to look, in the case of perennials, for instance, and really, no matter where we are, because morphologically, you know, structurally, those three groups of plants that we just named as families are, they're structurally, they're again accessible.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
We're going to look probably in those families, and I can give the links you alluded to, like some of the websites that may have lists by bioregion of keystone plants and so forth. And I can give some links with the transcript of the show over on awaytogarden.com where people can do a little homework. But again, you have to know what your keystone plants for what, you know, you're looking for, which is a little more complicated.
Well, for pollinators, I think there's another really fantastic resource that's by a man named Jared Fowler.
Oh, yes.
F-O-W-L-E-R. And he has these really wonderful lists of native perennials and all of the bee species that they support or that they've known to associate with. And you get, you know, there's plenty of options in composite family and mint and carrot family, and then loads of others. And that gives you, again, that sort of research-based, data-based background to inform your choices in a garden of which perennials you can include to support not only the generalists, but also with an eye to the specialists.
Right. And in woody plants, I mean, I mentioned, you know, that Doug has taught us so much about the oaks, but in woody plants, are there some, I mean, you know, for instance, in your work at Native Plant Trust, are there some genera of woody plants that you feel like are real powerhouses that you're, you know, you see their contribution as outsize, kind of?
Yeah, I think of, first one that comes to mind are viburnums.
Oh.
And, you know, viburnums, I think, are you know, there's a good deal of diversity. The flowers support a lot of pollinators. There are a number of Lepidoptera that host on viburnums. And then you have the added benefit of really nutritious fruit that birds rely on in the fall. And so you really get a whole, you know, different sets of interactions as the season goes by. And then I think from the human perspective, you know, they're beautiful shrubs. They've got wonderful fall color. You know, if you want an alternative to your burning bush, like put in a viburnum nudum and you won't be disappointed. So that comes to mind, a lot of the vacciniums. So either,
I was
going to
say,
bush,
I'm crazy about blueberries. Yeah. I'm crazy about blueberries. Yeah.
Yes. And all for all the same reasons that, you know, the flowers support a variety of pollinators. The birds love the fruit. If, you know, you have to compete with them a little bit to get the fruit, but, fall color is exceptional. I mean, there's all these things that kind of converge and I think make them, real keystone species in a garden.
See, and with the blueberries, I've never really picked any of, I've had some of them for the shrubs for 30 plus years, but I'd sort of tucked them all in these kind of what I call bio hedges, these kind of, you know, at the borders of the property, all these woody plant combinations, you know, they're everywhere. There's a few here and a few there and a few everywhere. And the insects and the birds love them. They're not for me. And what is for me is that the gorgeous red fall color and the, you know, they're beautiful. They're beautiful plants, but they don't need any much attention, yet they draw in all the wildlife.
Yeah. So. And I think this is a good segue to the idea of you know, the right balance between, you know, what I would call necessary maintenance in gardens. So, you know, making sure that there aren't leaves on your stone patio that are going to cause you to slip and fall. And that balance with what I would think of as really ecologically forward practices, like, you know, leaving stems, leaving the leaves, the idea of creating soft landings, you know, your intentional hedges that, you know, are not for you to harvest from, but are for the wildlife.
Right.
Intentional brush piles. I really, my friend Edwina Van Gaal and her snake habitat that she created.
Yes.
I love that. I absolutely love
that.
Yes. So I think that's sort of another perspective to bring into this conversation that, you know, you can really maximize the impact of keystone species by pairing those plants with a balanced approach of how you maintain your garden. You know, because there's not much point in planting a viburnum if you're going to then blow all the leaves away in the fall and rake it up and then replace it with wood chip mulch. And
right, so, let alone an oak tree where, you know, I mean, where goodness knows how many creatures are going to be in the leaf litter of that tree that's going to be fairly persistent.
Absolutely.
You know,
absolutely.
you want to try to let that be, as you say, like a soft landing, a place that can perpetuate and be largely untouched, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, you know, you start to put together, you know, this concept of a real, you know, workhorse is another one of these workhorse species that gets,
yes.
that gets
yes.
thrown out. That idea and the fact that gardens aren't just for us anymore, and combined with some really, you know, conscientious and ecologically sensitive maintenance practices, and the result is a garden that bursts with life, that
right.
provides all of these wonderful opportunities for you to observe, to be inspired, to, you know, gain all of the benefits of gardening, which we know is less stress and more happiness.
Yeah. Well, one more, we have like a minute just left. One more tree or shrub, for instance, that you want to shout out, because I just think the woody plants are so important and they're permanent, you know, fixtures in the garden. And they're so important.
I'm going to call out dogwoods.
Yay. Oh, good, good,
you know,
good.
Because I think you have both, you know, the beautiful small flowered, you know, Cornus florida, and its red fruit again, and the interactions, and then all of the wonderful shrubby ones that exist in our wetland margins that that have similar to the viburnums, the ability to draw different groups of organisms throughout the season. So, you know, my top two are going to be dogwoods and viburnums.
Okay. Well, Uli Lorimer, it's always fun to talk to you. And yeah, Keystone Plant, I think it's been one of the phrases of the year for sure. I've heard it more and more and more
Indeed.
all the time. So I look forward to talking to you again soon. Thanks for making time today.
Absolutely. Thanks for
and
having
stay
me.
Stay warm over there, okay?
We'll do. We'll do. You do the same.
Okay.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for tuning in. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com and on Facebook and on Instagram as @awaytogarden. And happy gardening, including with Keystone Plants. Meantime.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden provided by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, a third-generation bulb company offering top-size flower bulbs directly to landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners on the web, colorblends.com. And by High Mowing Seeds, Wolcott, Vermont, professional quality vegetable, flower, and herbal seeds that are 100% organic and non-GMO project verified. On the web, HighMowingSeeds.com. And by White Flower Farm, offering a wide range of carefully selected and expertly grown garden plants. On the web, WhiteFlowerFarm.com.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of AwayToGarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.